Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 16th day of February 2018. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, out of the office traveling, so no update of the commodity markets for the afternoon. Coming up, however, in this half hour, we'll talk with Tony Studer. He's a researcher in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, looking at the way corn utilizes water. And he may have some possibilities to make that even more efficient. We'll talk with him in detail about how his research is looking at the size of the leaf and transpiration and what might be incorporated into the corn plant sometime in the not-so-distant future. We'll also, if you can stick around with us for the second half hour, talk with the new entomologist here on campus, Nick Sider, and the new plant pathologist, Nathan Kruszewski. And as we close out our time together, the weed scientist for U of I Extension, Aaron Hager, will be here with an unfiltered discussion of dicamba. You won't want to miss it, so stay with us for the whole hour if you can, right here on Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Hey, have you purchased your tickets for the all-day agricultural outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana yet? I hope so, but if not, you can do that online right now at willag.org, that's willag.org, or by calling this number, 800-898-1065. The all-day ag outlook began way back in 1991, and we have great years each and every year. This year, there'll be more than a dozen analysts there to talk about the commodity markets. We'll also take up block trades and variable rate storage, some changes that are coming to corn and soybean futures in Chicago. At the CME Group, we'll hear about the agricultural weather forecast and discuss dicamba too. The all-day ag outlook is at the Beef House the first Tuesday of the month of March. That's the sixth day. We'll open our doors at 8 a.m. Central Time and run through the mid-afternoon. Be sure to get your $30 ticket right now online, willag.org. 800-898-1065. And the ticket includes your morning coffee and roll from the Beef House and your noon hour lunch also from the Beef House. Buy them right now. $30, 800-898-1065 or willag.org.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for more than 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really. Thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're joined now by Tony Studer. He's a plant geneticist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I and has been making the rounds on the Extension meetings this winter, talking about transpiration and corn, plant breeding, and some of the work he's been doing in his lab. Very interesting things you discussed today with the folks in Champaign, Illinois, about corn. Its background and how it uses water. What was it that clicked in your mind that you wanted to begin to explore this area?
So I've been working on photosynthesis and water use for about 6.5 years now. And when you look at some of the most variable things that farmers deal with in their field, it's the weather. And so if we could make more resilient lines, lines that used water more efficiently, that would give the farmers more protection against times of drought. And so the analogy I like to use is when you walk out in your field during grain fill or pollinations, worst possible time for the plant to have stress. You know a rain event's coming in a day or two, but you see the leaves rolling today. And so if we could make the plant more efficient in a way that it saves water, you would have that water in the soil for those times of dryness and the plant would never see stress.
Commercial operations have been doing this for a while. They actually have varieties out there that have names that give us an idea that they're trying to save water. Why would you explore this area? Is it really needed?
So that's one of the things you have to balance as a public researcher, is the commercial companies have a lot more money than I do to do the research, and they're also interested in a lot of the same topics, those things that are important to farmers. But we can take a unique approach. And so since we're not driven by the same motives, that same bottom dollar that they are, we can take a step back and take a broader approach to it. We can explore lines that are outside of commercial germplasm, older lines that maybe have unique traits that use water more efficiently, but they're not in a commercial program right now. And so we're able to study the basic science, look at a few more lines, and then move that towards a commercialized product that then a company could take up.
You've been doing the research for a while. Have you been successful in finding genetic traits that may or may not be incorporated into future hybrids?
So we do have a few things now that look very promising. And so we know traits that affect water use. We have some idea of genes that affect water use, and we have lines that use water differently. And so now we're to the point where we've made hybrids with these more efficient lines, and we're getting them out for field testing now this summer, where we're actually comparing to some of the commercial hybrids you mentioned that use water efficiently.
How does the corn plant use water, and how can you make it more efficient?
So it uses water to move nutrients. It uses water for growth. The aspect of water use that I'm talking about is mainly that transpiration. And so on the surface of the leaf, the plant has to bring in CO2 for photosynthesis to make the yield, but it loses water out of that same leaf. And so by affecting the transpiration, just the water lost, so not water used, but water lost, by reducing that quantity, then we can save the water in the soil for what the plant really needs it for.
But how do you do that? I mean, what do you look at? What is it that causes the plant to lose water?
So you can actually do it a few different ways, and we have projects focused on many of those. And so you can actually reduce the leaf area, and so only produce as much leaf area as you need to fill that grain. And so if you reduce the area, you're reducing the area that loses water. You can also change the pores on the leaf, the stomata on the leaf, that open and close in response to the environment that bring in CO2 and lose water. So if you tune that, if you really make that efficient, then by affecting that, you can save water.
Let's take those up individually. So how do you tune the stomata, and does it make a difference?
So a lot of people don't realize that there are those little pores on the leaf to begin with. And they're usually even more surprised to find out how dynamic they are. So they're actually changing their size on a second-by-second basis in response to a cloud that goes overhead or a bright sunny day. And so that movement can actually be optimized. And so in an agricultural setting, it's very artificial. It's not like a natural environment where plants grow. And so we can actually change the genes involved with that opening and closing to make it more responsive to an agricultural environment, to really tilt it in our favor. And so that's how you do that on the stomata level.
You'll have to forgive me. I'm going back to my science years ago. The stomata on the underside of the leaf, is that correct? And then these open and close to allow what to happen?
So there are plants that have stomata on only the bottom or only the top, but maize is a crop that has stomata on both surfaces. So it actually has stomata on the top and the bottom. And they're opening and closing to bring in CO2, and then just a byproduct of that opening is where you get transpirational water loss. So you have to bring in CO2. If you just completely shut the stomata to save water, you bring in no CO2, the plant doesn't grow. And so that's really how we have to balance this, is because you have to bring in CO2. They have to remain open at some level, but the more we can keep them closed, the more water we save. And so when you're talking about water use efficiency or making the plant more efficient, we really have to balance the water use without impacting yield. Because a farmer's not going to want to grow a more water use efficient line if it reduces their yield values. And so that's what we're really working on. And it looks like we're achieving that, where we have lines that maintain yield but use less water.
Do they stay closed more often when it's sunny? Do they stay closed more often when it's cloudy? What happens?
So say it's early in the morning, it's dark outside. The stomata are closed because no photosynthesis is going on. The sun rises, the stomata open, so that they can bring in CO2 and start the photosynthetic process. And then as the day heats up, they respond to the heat, so they start to close again. And so depending on what the day looks like on a second-by-second basis, they'll open and close to various degrees. But they want to be open in daylight hours, because that's when you're making your energy.
And how do you control, or what have you found that controls this, that allows them to be closed more often?
So it's signal perception. So we're actually, it's not only the mechanics of the opening and closing that we're affecting, but it's actually the perception of signals. And so it's the sensing. And so you can think of your senses as, you know, smell, hearing, sight, but the plant can actually sense in those stomata changes in temperature, humidity, light. And so how it registers those signals and perceives those signals, if we can change that, we can change how they respond.
Leaf area. Let's discuss that for just a bit. You talked about narrower leaves than what are generally available now on hybrids, and that there is a mutant that allows this to happen. However, I was thinking about the leaf and its ability to collect sunlight. You would think that leaf area that would be larger would be better. What have you found?
So you have to think about, or I try to get people to think about, what does that optimum plant look like? What does it take to have an optimum plant? And to a farmer, the optimum plant is one that produces the most grain. And so my job, really, from a research standpoint, is to figure out what that optimum plant looks like. How many leaves does that plant have? What does the leaf area look like? And so you mentioned, which is perfectly natural to take that line of thinking, bigger leaves, more photosynthesis, more grain. But really, plants can overproduce leaves. And so when you invest carbon and energy into making leafy material that eventually gets shaded out in a canopy type setting, that's carbon and energy you're not harvesting out of the field. And so if you can optimize how much leaf area it puts out, then it can take the remaining energy and put that into the grain. And so we're using mutants that affect leaf area and narrow those leaves down to really find out what's the optimum leaf. And then we can convert the rest of that into grain.
So you're very early in this process. You have had it in the field. Can you tell me about one of the experiences with putting these seeds in the ground and what you saw at the beginning of the season and your reaction and then what was truly happening?
Yeah, last year we had these lines out, and we planted the mutants and we planted the wild type. And so shortly after planting, I took the students out to the field, and we were going to look at these mutants. And much to my surprise, there was no mutants out there. There was nothing that had a difference in leaf area. And so I brought the team together, and I said, okay, we've made a mistake. We've misplanted. We've packaged wrong, and so kind of gave a little speech about attention to detail and diligence, because it's always troubling when you think you've misplaced seed. And so we replanted the experiment, and I went out a little bit later in the season to that first plot, and I found plants with narrow leaves. And so it was a great day because the students were diligent. You know, they really spent a lot of time on these projects. And so there was no mistakes. They were relieved. I was relieved. But really what that told us about those plants is they actually show that narrow leaf later in development. It was something that was totally unexpected. It's almost like the ideal scenario. And so to a farmer, they want early vigor. And so you want early vigor so that you get canopy cover, you're intercepting as much light as possible, and you're shading weeds. And so you don't want to start the season with a narrow leaf plant. However, this mutation seems to be hardwired into development. And so there is a transition in a corn plant between juvenile waxy leaves and adult leaves. And so it appears, and we're investigating this further, but it appears that sometime during that transition, that this is hardwired into development to the point where you have normal leaves at the beginning of the season, and then you have narrower leaves when you want them as the plant matures. And so it could be grown under higher densities or more narrow row spacing. And so these are all things that we're looking at right now.
A couple of final questions. Exploration, scientific, for itself sometimes is just to explore, to understand, to learn. What have you learned from your exploration into corn genetics?
Wow. One of the things that I'm always surprised by is the amount of variation you have in corn. And so what's interesting at the sequence level is if you look at the DNA between two different inbred lines of corn, there's more sequence differences than the DNA between humans and chimps. And so if you can think about how different humans and chimps are from each other, there's more diversity in different lines of corn. And so I am continually surprised at the genetic level, how much variation there is, and then encouraged by that because that means that there's diversity in photosynthesis, in water use that's not always, you don't always see that kind of diversity in crop plants. And so since it's there naturally in corn, we can mine that diversity and use it to the benefit of the farmer.
And the second question follows up on that. How quickly can this be mined and incorporated into what farmers see in their fields?
A question I often get when I talk to a very applied audience, you know, they like what they see. Even the things that we're in early phases of testing on, they're pretty exciting. You know, I get excited every day when I go to work. And so you think about how long it's actually going to take. One of the things I do in my program is we look at these things in hybrids. We look at off-patent commercial material to try to get as close to what the farmer would grow as possible. Really testing those in that kind of setting is important to the transfer to a company. You know, we have to know how it's going to perform in a commercialized setting. And so you ask how long. I think with, you know, in a commercial breeding program with lots more money than I have and lots more people, you know, a trait can take 10 years. I think with technology and some of the steps we're taking in the lab, company engagement actually early on in the process will make that process a little bit faster. And so by, you know, this year we're doing some pretty extensive testing. In the next couple of years, we'll probably have large scale testing in multiple locations. And so then, you know, maybe a company will license something.
How does that happen? Last question for you, actually. How does that happen? Because in the university system, we used to have public varieties and still do. And it was easy for end users, farmers in this case, to understand how research on campus translated into their fields. Much more difficult for them to get a handle on where those traits that are in the field come from today because they're, well, commercialized and they have a brand on them.
Yeah, so the process has changed as companies have evolved over time. And so now it's not necessarily the release of a variety from me, from the University of Illinois. What that instead looks like is the university has a lot of lawyers involved in technology management, technology transfer. And so if we produce something that has value, the university owns that. It's a public institution. You know, they own the investment in that material. And so then through, like I said, cooperation with companies and engagement, if a company sees something they like that the university then can patent, they license that technology to a company that's interested. And I use technology very loosely because that's the term that they use, but technology can be, you know, biological process, it could be germplasm, it could be, you know, take a lot of different faces.
The land grant mission, is that something that you adhere to that you like?
Yeah, it's actually a second slide in my presentation today. At a land grant university, there's really a three-part mission. And so there's the research standpoint, which we've talked a lot about here today. There's also education. And so I tell people, and some people are surprised to find out that I teach. And so I teach a graduate course right now in plant gene regulation, and I'll be taking over undergraduate genetics course. And so I'm excited to start teaching undergrads at the U of I. And so there's this educational component. I have students in my lab, undergraduates, graduate students that we're training to be the next generation of scientists or farmers or, you know, as they go out. And so we have that standpoint. And then also the third part, which is also very important, that's extension. Extension and outreach. And so as a land-grant university, my best days are the days that I'm doing research, education, extension all together. Today is going to be one of those days because I get to do them all. And so from an extension standpoint, I like to get out, talk to the growers, the stakeholders about what I'm doing at the lab, the exciting things going on at the U of I, and how that eventually it may look different than it used to, but how eventually those discoveries actually do trickle to their field.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That, of course, is Tony Studer. He is a plant geneticist at the University of Illinois. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by
the Friends of WILL and from Busey. With nearly 150 years of agribusiness experience, Busey offers solutions, resources, and expertise to support landowners. Busey, your dream, our promise.
Hey, have you purchased your tickets for the all-day agricultural outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana yet? I hope so, but if not, you can do that online right now at willag.org, that's willag.org, or by calling this number, 800-898-1065. The all-day ag outlook began way back in 1991, and we have great years each and every year. This year, there'll be more than a dozen analysts there to talk about the commodity markets. We'll also take up block trades and variable rate storage, some changes that are coming to corn and soybean futures in Chicago. At the CME Group, we'll hear about the agricultural weather forecast and discuss dicamba, too. The all-day ag outlook is at the Beef House the first Tuesday of the month of March. That's the sixth day. We'll open our doors at 8 a.m. Central Time and run through the mid-afternoon. Be sure to get your $30 ticket right now online, willag.org. 800-898-1065. And the ticket includes your morning coffee and roll from the Beef House and your noon hour lunch also from the Beef House. Buy them right now. $30, 800-898-1065 or willag.org.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Almond Day. It's also Feast of the Sticky Buns Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1883, the Ladies' Home Journal began publication. In 1897, P. Walker was issued a patent for his invention of a machine for seeding cotton. In 1909, Richard McDonald was born. He was one of the brothers who founded McDonald's fast food restaurants. Richard also designed the Golden Arches logo. The first McDonald's, by the way, was at 15th and E Streets in San Bernardino, California in 1940. The chain began 8 years later. And today, more than 245 billion McDonald's hamburgers have been served. In 1932, James E. Markham of Stark Brothers Nurseries and Orchards in Louisiana, Missouri, received the first patent for a fruit tree. It was for a peach tree whose fruit ripened later than other varieties. In 1937, Dr. Wallace Hume Carruthers, a research chemist for DuPont, received a patent for his invention of nylon. One of its first uses was to replace the hog bristles that had been used in toothbrushes. Commercial production of yarn for nylon hosiery soon followed. And in 1948, the first U.S. newsreel aired on television. Broadcast by NBC, the program was sponsored by a tobacco company. And that's this day in agricultural history.
When you leave the hallowed halls of Illinois.
You know, there's a story here at the University of Illinois.
There is just one thing you can't forget, my boy.
And it is a very true story.
It's an old established room.
Our undergraduate library, the place where students go and study, our undergraduate library is built underground. And that happened for only one reason.
Oh, you can't throw shit on the corn. It'll die as sure as your corn. No, sir, we don't mess around. Now that berry's underground, because you can't throw shade on the corn.
Nope, you just can't throw shade on the corn in the Marl Plots.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the story about the undergraduate library is the fact that it's actually built underground rather than above ground to reduce any impact of shade on the Marl Plots.
That's agronomist Bob Dunker. He takes care of the Marl Plots and says the undergraduate library isn't the only building adjusted downward to keep the sunshine on the corn. And it's all happened for good reason.
Well, you know, it really is a historical continuum, kind of a living museum. You know, it was established in 1876, and it's the longest continuous research plot in America, and actually has the longest continuous corn plot in the world that has been documented. And you know, over the series of that time, it's been pretty much managed very similar as far as rotational scheme and looking at the effects of both fertilizer and crop rotation on soil quality.
Well, the Marl Plots, established in the mid-late 1800s, are just about as old as the University of Illinois itself. This land grant was established in 1867. The Marl Plots were much bigger back then. Three of the original plots remain, says Bob Dunker.
You know, originally there were 10 plots in the Marl Plots, and now there actually are three, plots 3, 4, and 5, and Plot 3 has been in continuous corn since 1876, and, you know, Plot 4 has been in a two-year rotation from 1876 until 1967, was in a corn-oats rotation, and then soybeans were swapped out for oats after that period to more closely reflect what our typical agriculture is for this day. And Plot 5 has always been in a three-year rotation. It still has oats. It's a corn-oats alfalfa rotation. And so that's our three-year rotation.
The continuous corn plots, the plot that hasn't ever been seeded with anything other than corn, typically has the lowest yields. The three-year corn-oats alfalfa rotation has the best long-term average yield. You can come see the Marl Plots for yourself on the University of Illinois campus. They're just to the east of the underground undergraduate library. The Marl Plots song, as performed by the other guys, they've been an a cappella group on campus since 1968. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much.
This is a special production agriculture edition of Commodity Week. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Three topics for the day: entomology, plant pathology, and dicamba. We'll start with entomology. Nick Sider is the Extension entomologist here on campus. I caught up with him and asked about the western corn rootworm and whether or not it's really building problematic resistance to the products used to control it.
Well, we are starting to lose a little bit of susceptibility to some of the BT toxins that are expressed in some of these corn hybrids, specifically Cry3BB1 and MCry3A, starting to lose potentially some susceptibility with the Herculex toxin, but it does seem to be a little more effective, and so a lot of times we're relying more on the stacked hybrids now. But it, you know, as an insect, corn rootworm is very adept at developing resistance to various control tactics for it, and so it's been expected for a long time, but we are starting to see this situation develop.
Are there areas or geographies in the state where it is more pronounced than others?
We would like to figure that out. So we've got a fairly good handle on what's happening near Champaign-Urbana, hoping to get a better idea of characterizing that throughout the state over the next few years.
Farmers report very often damage from this insect last summer and the crop that we raised.
Well, I wasn't here last summer. One thing I am asking growers to do going forward is when they do have damage, you know, greater damage than they would expect on one of these hybrids, to let us know about it so that we can get a better idea of where it's most prevalent throughout the state. More than likely, it's going to go right along with areas of heavy corn rootworm pressure, and particularly where we have areas of heavy rootworm pressure along with historical corn after corn. Continuous corn production will, of course, favor not just rootworm populations, but also provides the opportunity for them to be exposed to the same toxin in subsequent years in the same field.
Yeah, so there are two different variants of the rootworm, or were at one point. And I don't know whether these populations have joined into just one variant that will lay eggs in soybeans so that it would show up in first-year corn. Normally, in the past, until it adapted sometime in the mid-1990s to this practice, rotation that is, it would only lay eggs in corn and then naturally be controlled because of the rotation.
Yeah, we still have plenty of rotation resistance out there, particularly right where we are in east central Illinois. If you look throughout the distribution of this insect, where you start to get into areas where the landscape is more homogeneous, so where more of the non-crop area is not going to be rotated to corn the following year, that's where you start to see the variant kind of fade out. And so as you go into southern Illinois, you have more hills, you have more forest, you have more other areas where if a corn rootworm lays its eggs there, those eggs are not going to survive the following year. And so that variant trait, which is essentially to go out into any bare ground, any cracks and crevices, any place that it can find and lay its eggs, that only really pays off if about 90% of the landscape or more is rotated corn and soybeans. Once you start to drop below that, then a lot of those eggs are being wasted if they're being laid in non-crop areas that aren't going to be rotated to corn. And so we've kind of, the spread of the variant has sort of slowed as it's reached some of those areas where the trait doesn't pay off for the insect.
Are there management techniques that you're recommending for producers in this growing season for 2018?
Well, and you know, the big thing is to know your field, to know the pressure that you have based on beetle numbers the previous year, based on field history, based on what you've been seeing, and to choose a management tactic appropriately. These management tactics, along with all the management tactics that we have for rootworm, are overused in a given year. They're being used on a lot of acres that probably don't economically justify a treatment for corn rootworm. And that's the big thing. If we want to preserve these tools in the long term, the best way to do that is to not use them where they're not needed. By doing that, you reduce the exposure in the rootworm population to these traits. You break up that cycle a little bit so that they're not being continuously exposed to the same control method year after year after year. Anywhere you get into that situation where the same insect is being exposed to the same control over and over and over again, that's how resistance develops.
Let's transition, but use an insect to do that, because I think it shows up on both crops pretty regularly, the Japanese beetle. Is it a problem in Illinois?
It was a problem last year, particularly in parts of western Illinois. We hit some pretty heavy pockets of that. Of course, it's a defoliating insect in soybean. It will actually clip the silks in corn if you get high enough numbers. Part of my message to the growers today, specifically dealing with soybeans, is that the soybean crop can take a lot more of that defoliation than most people think. We're talking about a threshold of 30% defoliation before bloom, 20% defoliation after bloom. When you think about 20% defoliation on average, not just through a plant but through a field, that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of defoliation, but that's what it actually takes to justify a treatment for not just Japanese beetle, but any defoliating insect that you have out there.
And then the brown marmorated stink bug is an insect that we've heard a lot about. We know something about the stink bug, but this one, while it's been in the United States for a while, has really begun to come on as an insect that causes damage in crop fields.
Yeah, so historically in Illinois, we've not had major problems with stink bugs in our row crops. One of the reasons that brown marmorated stink bug is on our radar, it's an invasive species that can hit pretty tremendous numbers in some cases. In the mid-Atlantic states, it's hit pretty incredible numbers. But it's also very well adapted to cold climates. It does overwinter in people's homes, in their barns, in behind tree bark and leaf litter, has different ways of protecting itself from the cold, little better adapted to the cold than some of our native stink bugs, and so we're concerned that if this insect establishes in Illinois, increases in numbers, we could have problems with this stink bug that we're not really used to dealing with because we're not used to having to manage the other stink bugs that are out there. In row crops, in terms of the damage that it does, it's very similar to the brown stink bug and the green stink bug. Very manageable. The threshold in soybeans is 9 per 25 sweeps, whether it's brown marmorated or green or brown. Where it could really cause a problem would be in some of our vegetable and fruit crops, where its feeding damage can actually ruin those fruits for fresh market, which of course significantly reduces the value of that crop. So that's where we're really concerned with it, but it is a concern to row crops as well.
Hey, Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nick Sider is an extension entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Up next, we'll take up plant pathology, but first a quick reminder to buy your tickets for the All-Day Ag Outlook. It's the sixth day of March at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Details are online at willag.org. There you can pick up your tickets as well, or you can call this number, 800-898-1065. Now let's talk about diseases in corn and soybeans. I asked plant pathologist Nathan Kruszewski from the University of Illinois what new might be coming to the state.
Well, we're looking at some new diseases that are coming into corn and soybeans that we've identified in Illinois and nearby states. And so really, I'm trying to raise awareness of some of these diseases and inform the growers what we know about these diseases and what they can do to potentially manage them in the future.
And new usually indicates that it's something fun and that we ought to have. But in this case, I take it that's not really what you want. Tell me about some of the corn diseases that may be coming to the state.
So we have a couple new diseases in corn that have been detected here in Illinois in recent years. One is bacterial leaf streak, and that's a pretty new disease. We're starting to learn a little bit more about it. It's becoming more prevalent, especially out west in Colorado and Nebraska, and we're finding out that it's really something that probably came here from maybe another country and has the potential to overwinter in corn residue. And so there's been a lot of work in terms of variety selection production and trying to understand that pathosystem as well. And so really I'm talking to the growers about how to identify it, making sure that they're not confusing it with other diseases, and kind of understanding what will and will not work, at least what we know right now with bacterial leaf streak.
Is it a disease that no-till or low-till folks, conservation tillage, would be more likely to see than conventional tillage?
I would suspect so, because we do have some information from Colorado that seems to indicate that the more corn residue that you have on the surface of your field, the more likely you are to have more of the bacteria the next time you plant corn. But if you rotate away, you know, that's an option to help degrade some of that corn stover as well.
How much of an impact has it had in those places that it is prevalent?
In the last couple of years, they've indicated maybe 5 to 15% yield losses in susceptible hybrids. And again, they're getting blasted with a lot of water over there as well. So the environment needs to be really conducive to spread the disease.
And so irrigated areas would be more likely, I would think, too.
Right. Yeah, I would think irrigation would really play a factor. Again, so that's maybe not something that we're going to see a lot of here in Illinois. But if we get a lot of those just persistent wet conditions, it's something that could take off in some areas.
Yeah. Is it easily identifiable by the producer?
Easily, I wouldn't say easily identifiable, but there's ways of knowing that you might be dealing with it versus some of your more typical diseases than, you know, the gray leaf spot, northern corn leaf blight, anthracnose, things like that growers are accustomed to seeing in their fields.
Other than being able to rotate away from it, are there other control methods for this particular disease? And if not, what other diseases are we looking at in the state?
Well, in terms of managing, like I said, you know, if tillage is an option in your system and you've identified this disease in your field, you're going to want to rotate. You're going to want to till or bury that residue. Anything to break down that corn residue is going to be reducing your potential for disease. And eventually here, you know, in the next 5 years or so, I'm sure we're going to see some hybrids with good resistance coming out, and that's going to be another line of defense against this particular disease. The important thing that you need to keep in mind is that fungicides aren't going to work. So if you're out there spraying a fungicide, or you think this is a fungal disease, and you know, you misidentify it, you can be wasting a lot of money on it. So that's the main thing. The other disease that we're looking at in corn is tar spot. That's something new that we've seen in the area. That's actually a complex of two pathogens. And in Mexico, where they find it most often, and it's really a problem, they have an obligate pathogen that needs a living host called Phylacora. That produces the black tar spot type symptom that you see on the leaf. And then there's a second pathogen, and that was it, Monogryphella, I believe, comes in, and that's actually a saprophyte. So what that does is that pathogen needs the Phylacora, we're not sure why, to infect first. And then once that happens, the Monogryphella will come in, will infect and produce toxins, and those toxins kill the plant tissues, and then they live off of that dead decaying tissue. So when those two are together, you get some really astounding yield losses. And here in Illinois, where we found tar spot, you know, we found it in parts of the United States, Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Florida now, we've only found the Phylacora, which we don't think is associated. We have no evidence that that would be associated with yield loss. We've never detected the Monogryphella yet, but we want to look for it. We want to make sure that we know if we have that, so that we can take that into consideration and do some work.
So good news, bad news there. The bad news is it's here. The good news is not both parts of it are here, so right. You don't have to worry about it as much. Soybeans, what kind of plant disease is there?
So, you know, the big disease that people have on their minds is SDS. So that's something I've been talking with growers about, some of the research that's been conducted out of the North Central region in the last few years, giving them updates on some of the work being done with variety and also with Olivo and economics, and trying to see, you know, under what conditions you're going to end up having your best return on your investment or best probability for success. And then we have a new disease in the South called taproot decline, and that's one of those diseases that looks like a lot of other diseases we have in soybeans that affect the roots and the stem. And so I've been just trying to let growers know what they could potentially see in the future, or if they see symptoms that looks like taproot decline, to let us know so that we can, you know, again, stay ahead of the curve. I don't like playing catch up with a lot of diseases. I like being ahead of the curve.
Information from your colleagues here at the University of Illinois says that it's okay to plant soybeans much earlier in the year than farmers generally have done that. They're already doing that to some respect. Olivo is one of those things, I believe, that they'll be looking at as a way to protect that seedling and the crop throughout the year. Is this worthwhile as a treatment?
So if you have a field with a history of SDS and you've had issues with it before and you are just going in early, you're putting yourself at a position where you're more likely to see SDS symptoms that year because you're planting early. You might have colder soils, you might have wetter soils, and that's a condition that the Fusarium vigoliformia that causes SDS really likes. It's really conducive to its growth and infection. So in that case, utilizing a product like Olivo might be beneficial for you. Now, you can't control the environment. If you don't have those wet, cool conditions, Olivo, you might not see SDS at all, and basically you have wasted that treatment, so that input. So that's when you have disease, it's great. When there's no disease, it's an input that you spent money on that doesn't work. And that's why the resistant varieties in SDS are a really good tool, because the yield potential's there. They're always giving you that resistance. And even if SDS isn't there, they can still give you that yield that you need. So I like utilizing multiple tactics to combat diseases, especially difficult diseases like SDS.
So would you use an SDS-resistant variety in a place that you would be going in early and then have the seed treatment on hand on the idea that the conditions at the time of planting may or may not be representative of that cool, wet climate?
No, it's difficult to make that sort of decision. I mean, it really is a gut feeling and what you feel like you're dealing with. There are other factors that could potentially lead to you using Olivo. You know, if you feel like you have nematode pressure, SCN, or maybe some other nematodes that could potentially reduce your yields. I mean, we know that Olivo has some impacts there, although the jury's out in terms of how effective it is, but it does have that sort of activity. And it is a fungicide, so it can have impacts on some other diseases too, probably, that could be affecting your germination, your seed. So it's an input. Growers have to kind of weigh the risks and benefits and kind of make that decision before planting. I mean, in my mind, if you're planting on time, you're not planting early, and you don't have a history of SDS, there's no need for utilizing Olivo. But if you're going in early and you've got a history of SDS, your risk level, and if you look at your ladder and you're climbing that ladder, the higher up you go, the more risk you have. You're up towards the top of that ladder. So something you need to think about. Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much.
No problem. Thanks.
That's Nathan Krzyzewski. He is a researcher and a plant pathologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You can read what he and Nick Sider, entomologist, have to say about the growing season and bugs and diseases on the pest management website at the bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. Of course, you can hear them throughout the growing season. I'll be talking to them on our programming as well. Speaking of which, on the 6th day of March, we'll be over at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana for the All-Day Ag Outlook, and we'll take up one other topic that has to do with production agriculture, dicamba. We call this one Dicamba Unfiltered. We'll hear in just a moment from Aaron Hager, weed scientist at the U of I. He'll be at the Beef House, and you can be there too. Tickets are just $30. And you can buy them online at willag.org, that's willag.org, or by calling this number during regular business hours each day of the week, business day that is, at 800-898-1065. That's 800-898-1065. Back with Aaron in just a moment. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to Agricultural Programming from Illinois Public Media. We're now joined by Aaron Hager, weed scientist at the U of I. Aaron will be presenting at our all-day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana, the morning of March the 6th. You can buy your tickets right now if you'd like online at WILLAG.org or by calling this number, 800-898-1065. The title of his presentation, Dicamba Unfiltered. You'll want to be there, but let's get a quick preview of what he have to say. You've been following Dicamba for your whole career. This is a product that's been labeled for use in the United States, developed, I think, about 50 years ago.
It's actually a material, I think it was first registered in Illinois and across the U.S. in the early part of the 1960s. But at the time, we had different formulations of the product and certainly much different use patterns than what we have now, considering the fact of the dicamba-resistant soybean technology that's now in the marketplace.
In layman's term, it's hot. What makes it that way?
Dicamba is simply a herbicide that it's a dicot or a broadly specific herbicide, so really there's very little impact on grasses. But because of how it works, it's what we call a group 4 herbicide, which is a growth regulator type of herbicide. It can actually cause symptoms of exposure at doses that are very, very low in sensitive species. For example, if you take soybean, for example, it's one of the most sensitive dicot or broadleaf species to exposure to dicamba. And you can actually induce symptoms of exposure at rates as low as literally as 1/20,000th of a use rate in crop. So just a very, very small concentration, very, very low dose of dicamba spread out over an entire acre can actually demonstrate the symptoms of the exposure.
We've had a lot of problems with dicamba soybeans and those acres that were sprayed with both labeled and, I suppose, not labeled types of dicamba. It's been talked about in the press a whole lot. It's been in the law or in the court system. This coming year, what should producers be aware of and how should they handle this product if they're going to use it?
Well, number one, anybody who actually uses dicamba, one of these three approved formulations, regardless of whether it's in corn or soybean or other approved uses, on the labels has to go through a dicamba-specific training course. Here in Illinois, these courses are being conducted by the three registrants, and that's a requirement now on the federal label. There's been some changes in these labels for these materials that everyone who is considering using the technology must understand. There are extensive record-keeping requirements now. There's a list of about close to 20 items that need to be recorded after every application has been made. You have to be able to verify your tank cleanout and your equipment cleanout procedures that adequately removed any dicamba residues, even between applications. And there are statements at the on the label that appear to be quite troubling for applicators because there are statements about not making applications when you have situations where you have either adjacent or downwind sensitive crops, but there's no indication on the labels at what distance is considered adjacent or downwind. And what we have heard from the manufacturers is that they have no intention of putting a specific distance around these statements, but rather they will say that they are going to rely on the experience of the applicators about whether or not to make that application. The problem of it is if you have an applicator who believes based on their experience that it's legal to make that application and you do have an off-target movement take place, and a state inspector shows up, that state inspector might not have the same interpretation of whether or not that application should have been made.
So it is a very iffy situation in that case.
All the responsibility for physical off-target movement rests squarely on the shoulders of the applicators. That's something that the industry representatives have said repeatedly, and they mean that. They will not have any responsibility whatsoever for any type of physical movement out of these treated areas.
Aaron Hager is a weed scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. If you'd like to see him in person, you can do that at our all-day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Tickets are $30. You can buy them online at WILLAG.org. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. This is WILL AM 580, WILL FM 90.9, HD3, Urbana.